Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studios, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 a.m. Coming up a little bit later on, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. And also, we got a Blackhawks Express from a very exciting early game that the Hawks played yesterday, and we will play back that Express coming up as well. We are going to talk about the best animal performances, that, you know, animals that should have won Oscars. And we're also going to talk about animals in general on television and in movies and all kinds of cool stuff, very memorable animal performances. You know, we're approaching the Oscars, and maybe these animals should have been nominated. So we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But as you just heard, it is time for the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress and Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com, RogerEbert.com, and more join me each week. We review all the new movies, and then Eric discusses the box office, and we're going to do that right now. So let's welcome first Eric to the show. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hello, Colin.
Hello.
All right. So what? Now, Eric, have you have not seen A Cure for Wellness?
I did, yes.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Okay. And then let's see. Hold on one second. I'm just looking here. Colin, did you see? You didn't see Fist Fight?
I did not.
Okay, but you saw The Great Wall?
Yes.
And Eric, did you see The Great Wall?
I did.
Okay, because my updated list here doesn't have you down at it.
Okay.
So hold on. Let me just make sure I got all that. Okay, cool. Well, then, Colin, why don't you start with a United Kingdom?
All right. So this is based on a true story, and it stars David Oyelowo as a prince in Botswana in the 1940s who falls in love with a white woman in London named Ruth Williams, and it's played by Rosamund Pike. And when they meet in London, she has no idea he's royalty. And, you know, it could be king very soon. But they fall for each other pretty hard, and they cause an international stir when they eventually get married. Neither of their families approve of this relationship, much less the marriage. And when she makes her way to Botswana, there are conflicts with the citizens, and it takes a long while for people to accept the idea of their marriage, particularly the British, who do what they can in the name of apartheid to keep these two away from each other, going so far as to have them separated across continents for a number of years before they would see each other again. So the story here is a very interesting one. And, you know, the first film to come to mind when listening to the story, although this is on a much larger scale, and much more international scale, but the most recent film would be Jeff Nichols' Loving, which came out back in November. And this is a similar kind of interracial love story that has, you know, political meaning. But this is the movie that Loving was trying not to be. It kind of goes through all the usual motions of everything you expect to see from, an interracial love story that was, you know, taboo at the time. It has all the grandiose speeches, all the grandstanding, all the stuff that all the pitfalls that Loving did such a good job of avoiding, which is a real shame because Oyelowo and Pike are doing such a great job. I mean, the two of them are really terrific in the film. Unfortunately, you don't really get the sense of their chemistry. The movie kind of rushes through the whole getting to know you portion of the relationship and, you know, the build up to it, that you kind of wish the movie would have just skipped that part altogether and gotten, you know, just kind of dropped you into the middle of the relationship. I mean, I hate to kind of just hang on that comparison to the other film, but, you know, it does make a strong case for that sort of thing. And so I was never really all that invested in their relationship, even though I, you know, the historical significance of it is pretty important. And the movie just kind of, you know, while going, you know, while going through the motions of this kind of thing, it also, you know, paints all of the British characters in a sort of cartoonish bad guy sort of way. I mean, first of all, they cast Tom Felton as one of the bad guys. You know, yeah. Okay, so you got Draco Malfoy being Draco Malfoy in the whole story.
Right.
It's like, okay, come on, we can do better than this. And it's especially disheartening because the director of the film is, let me get her name, I'm sorry, I just had it here. Okay, Amma Asante, and I really liked her last film, which was a film called Belle from a couple of years ago. But this one just kind of falls short of its ambitions because, you know, for what the reasons I already stated. So, I mean, it's got two really solid performances at the center of it. Unfortunately, it's, you know, the material and the execution is one that is just too familiar to and too cliche to recommend the film.
Okay. It's playing. And Eric, did you see it?
I have not. No.
Okay. I haven't seen it either. It's playing at the River East. It's playing at the Century 12 in Evanston and the Landmark Century Center Cinema in Chicago. And that's called the United Kingdom. It's you know, Colin, Loving was such an exceptional movie. It's,
yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, because it absolutely, what you said, Loving completely sidetracks all of that stuff. And I think that's, you know, a minority in making films
mm-hmm.
like this. You know what I mean?
I don't want anyone to think I'm sitting here watching, you know, a movie like this thinking you're not doing what Loving did. You're not very good. It just, you know, when you walk out, when I walked out of the film, I felt like, oh, that's a good story, but I feel indifferent.
Okay.
About it. You know?
Okay. All right. There you go. All right. Eric,
mm-hmm.
Tell us about XX. Did you see this at Sundance?
Yeah, saw this at Sundance, and this is another horror anthology film. I think we talked about it a little bit at Sundance.
Yeah.
And it's but the thing that's being touted for is that the big difference between this and a lot of the other ones that we've seen is that all of the segments were directed by women, including Karen Kusama, who last did The Invitation, which we liked very much.
One of my favorite movies of last year, yep.
Yeah. So this one has four different stories and not so much a wraparound, but sort of like a little bridges in between with some stop motion animation that is actually turns out to be the best thing in the entire picture. The first story starts off with a Jack Ketchum tale about a box present that this boy sees on a train, and when this guy opens up the box, he becomes under some kind of spell and just has no appetite from now on. So then there's the mystery of exactly what was in the box and what is causing this kid not to eat. The second story involves Melanie Linsky as a woman who discovers her husband has died on the same morning that she is throwing a birthday party for her young daughter. And what is she going to do with the body to keep the birthday party intact? The third segment is your sort of typical group of campers go to a place and mess with evil forces, and evil forces takes one of them over, and, you know, insanity ensues. And then the fourth one is the one directed by Karen Kusama, and it is – I don't want to really tell you what it's about. All I will say is that it is either a sequel – or a blatant ripoff of a classic horror film. And it's really a shame to report that this is one of those rare anthologies that actually goes bats a zero. It's an 0-for-4 percentage on this. Normally you get, even in bad anthologies, maybe you get one or two segments that live up, or you get some moments here and there. For me, the chapters get kind of increasingly worse. The first one, the Jack Ketchum story, it held the most interest because it just kind of had a mystery to it. And then it just kind of, once you figure out where it's going, and it just kind of ends very unsatisfactorily. The Melanie Linsky episode just never really works. It doesn't, you know, it's not really horror. It's more supposed to be goofy, but it just doesn't really make any sense. The third one's actually quite bad. It's really just no innovation or anything interesting going on in the story with the campers. And the Kusama one is just odd because it's not particularly well done. It's not particularly scary. If it's supposed to be a sequel to something, it would be a straight to video sequel. And if it's just ripping off something, well, that's even worse. So yeah, I gotta say this is a real miss. On the part of XX.
Yeah, no, I didn't watch it, and it's available on demand. The thing that it's striking me, I'm looking at the page here.
Mm-hmm.
It's only an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Jeez. There's four stories, and it's only an hour and 20 minutes.
Yep.
Wow. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's an anthology, horror anthology. It's called XX, and Eric is not recommending it. By the way, one of the things that it says. You know how like IMDb will recommend other movies that you like.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking at this page, it also says that you should be interested in Colossal. Now,
okay.
All right, no. But you know, but I don't. I know you already talked about this movie, which comes out in a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the trailer for it. I cannot wait to see this movie.
You're gonna love it.
It's anime.
You are going to love this movie.
I'm telling you, man. Colin, have you seen the trailer for Colossal?
Not yet.
Oh man. Now I know, Dan, Eric, you've seen the movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the trailer, so I don't. I've heard it's actually a pretty well cut trailer, and they don't really give away too much.
No, it's a great trailer.
Okay.
You know, and I knew what it was about because you reviewed it.
Yeah.
But the trailer is. I mean, as soon as I saw the trailer, I'm like, well, that's going to be so great.
Yeah, it's about more than what people might think it is.
Yeah, now I can't wait. All right, okay, Eric and Colin, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Colin are going to hang on. We got to take a break here for the news, and we'll come back. We've got more new movies to talk about, and we'll also take you through the weekend box office as well. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We are here until 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday morning and it's a jokey time. And we will also hear yesterday's express from yesterday's Hawks game. And we're going to talk about great animal performances on television and in movies and all that fun stuff. So lots of stuff to do here on the show. Welcome. 312-981-7200. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected. Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me every Monday morning to review the new movies. And we're doing that right now. And then we'll take a look at the box office as well. So we welcome back Eric and Colin. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
All right. Colin.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about A Cure for Wellness.
All right. Well, this is the latest from so-called visionary director Gore Verbinski and was the biggest non-hit of the weekend. And it stars Dane DeHaan as a young executive named Lockhart, who has to go to this mysterious wellness center in the Swiss Alps. And he has to retrieve his company's CEO, who has taken up residence there and isn't answering any calls. So, you know, needless to say, everybody back home in I think it's New York, probably New York, is kind of in a panic, wondering where the CEO is and what's going on. And so Lockhart goes out there, and sure enough, there are no means to communicate with the outside world at this wellness center, and the CEO isn't planning on leaving anytime soon. So it's like this isolated paradise where people are sick but having a nice, peaceful time, getting better. Everything's just a little too pleasant. On his way back home, Lockhart gets into a car accident and is brought back to the wellness center and becomes a patient himself. And then figures out that maybe this place is not what it seems. They're putting him in sensory deprivation tanks for a long period of time. Everyone's kind of this strange demeanor about them. And so there's also told of a legend that took place hundreds of years ago, or a couple hundred, or whatever, however long ago it was. And once you hear that legend, everything kind of becomes a little clearer of what is going on, so much so that you're kind of well ahead of the rest of the film. And you have to sit there and spend whatever it is, an hour, hour and a half, left waiting for the main character to catch up to you while he's trying to figure it all out himself. And that's kind of a frustrating thing to sit through, because I'm not sure if it's you know, the bad screenwriting or just the way the film is directed. I mean, Gore Verbinski is doing some of his best work visually, but with the story and with the script, they are throwing so many MacGuffins at you along the way that you know you're kind of, or at least I knew I was being had through most of them. And I just kind of figured out, look, I know what's going on. I know who that person is. I know who that person is. And you're giving things away with just the title of the film. So when he finally catches up to it, it's not that big of a surprise. And so you're just kind of, I just kind of sat there watching the movie, admiring its visuals. I mean, really, this is a really wonderful film to look at. The production design is really exquisite. And I think what Verbinski is doing, you know, playing with reflections and mirrors and all that stuff is really wonderful. And I like the choice of the lead character. The casting of Dane DeHaan, I think, is perfect. And he takes quite a beating throughout the whole film, and he kind of deserves it. He's kind of a jerk at the beginning of the film, but I don't know. This movie is one of those films that I really never got tired of looking at, but I got pretty tired of waiting to end. It's a 2.5 hour film, and it doesn't really justify that length. And really, I mean, once the big reveal happens, and then there's more to that big reveal that has to happen on top of that, and it feels like the movie is already over at that point. So it's an unfortunate misfire from a director who I generally like. You know, I'm not the hugest fan of The Lone Ranger, and not many people are, but there's things about that movie I can defend, and for this film, I can defend its visuals and the casting, but not much of anything else.
Okay. All right, Eric.
Oh, I'm so glad Colin got to describe what this movie's about. as maybe the biggest defender of the visionary at the responsible for this movie on the show, I was bored silly with this film. I mean, the length is only one of its many problems. It's incredibly disinteresting from a very early point in the film. Yes, the visuals are the one thing that will keep you awake during the very long setup for this film. But this is a film that, you know, when it is creepy, and it can be creepy at times with things that happen to the Dane DeHaan character and visually some creepy stuff in the film, would have been much better served in like an 85-minute film. This is a film that, it, like Colin said, it is nearly 2.5 hours long, and it just seems to be almost feeling like some sort of contractual obligation that it needs to be 2.5 hours long. There's just scenes in the film that could easily have been cut, taken out, reduced. There are scenes in this movie where things happen to the Dane DeHaan character, really horrific things, and then there's a scene of him kind of, reacting to that or not reacting to that, and then he's fine again, and then something horrible happens to him again, and it repeats again. There seems to be some editing gaps even towards the end of this film where just like, wait a minute, didn't he just get really screwed up here? Why is, you know, there's moments where I thought the film was actually going to end prematurely, and it just doesn't. It just keeps going and going and going. Yeah, I mean, the visuals are about the only thing that I could say anything nice about in this movie. It's an ugly film and not in a good way. It's way too long. It's boring. I'm still not even entirely sure I know everything that happened in this film. I'm not on board with this film at all.
Yeah, I'm with you, Eric. I was bored out of my mind during this movie. Now, again, we've all mentioned the visuals. It's beautifully photographed. The cinematography and the production design and the look of the movie is really, 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 really great. So it looks great. But unfortunately, there's really no script here. And half the time, I didn't know what was going on. And in what you were saying, Eric, about the inconsistency of DeHaan's character, you know, is he okay? Is he not? It seems to me to be like the whole tone of the entire film, because it's like, is this real? Is it not real? And then it's who cares? And then, as Colin said, there are reveals in this movie where you're way ahead of the main character and there's no mystery whatsoever. And I just kept thinking, you know, to myself, you know, why am I not watching Shutter Island? I would so much rather be watching Shutter Island. And, you know, DeHaan has a resemblance to DiCaprio, you know, in a little physical kind of a way. And so I just kept thinking of Shutter Island, and I'm sure that can't be lost on the people who made this movie, you know. I'm assuming that the casting of Dane DeHaan, how do you not know? How do you not see that this guy, you know, looks like DiCaprio and kind of acts like DiCaprio, and that the setup for this movie is very similar to Shutter Island, only Shutter Island is 8 million times better. And I never thought this thing was going to end. I mean, it's 2.5 hours, and it feels like 2.5 hours. There were certain sequences in it that I thought were kind of creepy, and there's some stuff that they get. You know, this is for a commercial, you know, a Hollywood film. There's some really dark, twisted, sick stuff in this movie, and it's very explicit. And so I was like, okay, that's kind of cool that they're doing this in a big studio movie. And I, you know, I admire Gore Verbinski for his vision, I guess, and the fact that he pushes the envelope pretty good in this movie. I also think it's interesting that there's essentially nobody, you don't know anybody in these. And, well, Jason Isaacs, you kind of know, but, you know, the other actors in this movie, they're not stars by any stretch of the imagination. And judging by how much money the movie made over the weekend, clearly they're not draws. They're not, you know, they're not box office draws. So I kind of admire that they took this weird little route and they did it explicitly. So on a technical level, I have admiration for the way it looks and the envelope that it pushes and the fact that they did interesting casting as opposed to movie stars. But there's really a whole lot of nothing going on in this movie, and a whole lot of nothing for a whole lot of long time, if that's a sentence. So, yeah, and it did not do. Did not do well at the bottom. What's the budget for this one, Eric?
$40 million. Oh, man. Which doesn't seem bad until you look at how much it made.
Yeah. We'll get to that a little bit later on. But this is, I guess we could consider this a major flop.
It's a flop.
It's a flop, yeah. All right. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Anyway, that's A Cure for Wellness, and all three of us do not recommend it. And, yeah. So, all right. We're going to take a break, guys. Hang on. Hold on a second. There you go. Eric and Colin are going to hang on. When we come back, we got a couple more movies to review, and then we'll talk box office right here on 720 WGN. It's Monday morning. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here until 5 a.m. And how's everybody doing? It's Monday. My dad will be telling a joke because it's a jokey time. So we got my dad telling a joke. We'll have a recap of the Hawks game with the Express this morning. And we're going to be talking about great animal performances in movies and television and all that fun stuff. All right. Let's welcome Eric Childress and Colin Suter back to the show. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Hello.
All right. Eric, why don't you tell us about Fist Fight?
Okay. Well, this film stars Charlie Day as a teacher at high school. He is, you know, your typical... You know, just, you know, the guy that doesn't want to bother anyone. He's, you know, more than happy to have everyone run over him roughshod. Just doesn't want to rattle any cages, any feathers, and just go about his day. But at his high school, there is I guess you could call the exact opposite of him in the form of a teacher played by Ice Cube, who is loud and brash and feared. And will do anything he can get away with in his class, and to make sure the students do what they need to do and don't bother him, and he can, you know, go about his day.
Well, situation arises in one of the classes where Charlie Day witnesses Ice Cube doing some really horrific stuff in his class, and ends up ratting him out. Doesn't want to, risk his own chances at not being fired, as the school is undergoing some budget issues, and rats him out to the principal. And this causes Ice Cube to be so mad at him, he says, we're going to have a fist fight after school. And so Charlie Day spends the rest of the movie doing whatever he possibly can to get out of this fist fight. If this sounds familiar to anyone, you may be familiar with a little film from 1987 called 3 o'clock High. Mm-hmm. And, it's one thing, I always wondered when, movies that are this closely associated with something else, if they even will even take the bother to reference it or, God forbid, give Richard Tyson a cameo in the film or something like that, which would have been nice. Lord knows we haven't seen him in a while.
Yeah.
But this is a movie.
Or Casey Shemasko.
Casey Shemasko, for that matter. Yeah. It would have been nice to see them show up as teachers.
Or at least have a U2 song play on the soundtrack.
Something.
Because Phil Juwano.
Well, I would have settled for any frame of 3 o'clock High rather than what this film ends up being. This is a stunningly unfunny comedy. Like, dead silent, you can hear whispers coming out of the theater, unfunny. The prospect of having Charlie Day and Ice Cube as teachers at a high school to possibly, if you're not going to really do any kind of interesting commentary on high school dynamics or teachers for that matter, at least, maybe you're going to possibly do some sort of satire on racial relations, which this movie is absolutely toothless. And it has precisely one joke aimed at the obvious differences between these two men, and that happens to be over a cup of coffee. So it's the movie is absolutely toothless and doesn't even want to address that elephant in the room, and then just basically goes about structurally just kind of aping a lot of 3 o'clock High. I mean, a lot of it.
Yeah.
Different things that Charlie Day does in the film are things that Casey Shemasko did, short of robbing the school supply shop. And just about nothing in this film works. The situations don't work. I mean, Ice Cube deserves to be ratted out for his behavior in school. He plays such a psychopath that not in any good way, not in I'm doing this for the betterment of the students. He is a psychopath. And the fact that his character is allowed to get away with anything and just no one calls anyone's behavior out in this movie, it lends the kind of off-center unrealism that just makes this movie all the more unpleasant. The fact that it was directed by a guy who's done episodes of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is just triply disappointing, considering that he should know that, to handle the absurdity of this material with, much better grace or complete absurdity and go completely over the top with it, but he doesn't. It's everyone just struggling to find laughs in this movie. And another kind of proof that Charlie Day is better in maybe half-hour doses. I'd be shocked if this didn't end up on my worst list of the year.
Yeah, it's not good, but I laughed a few times. Also there's the movie does take place on the last day of school, so it's like senior prank day. So the movie is loaded with all of these weird pranks that people are pulling on teachers and the principal and all kinds of stuff. And I think some of the laughs from the movie come from that. There's a running joke with a mariachi band that actually made me laugh really hard. The students hired a mariachi band to follow the principal around, played by Dean Norris, who I actually thought was pretty funny in it too. So that made me laugh. There's a sequence in the movie where people are talking, because Ice Cube is like this, he's this sort of legendary mean crazy teacher, and there are these sequences where they talk about stories that they've heard about his past. Where he's like he was in Iraq, he was a cop. I thought those were very funny. I thought Charlie Day actually had some moments towards the end of the movie Tracy Morgan has a couple of funny laughs in it. But yeah, I mean, it steals completely from 3 o'clock High. And this is the second movie that I've seen in 3 weeks now where one of the climactic scenes is a inappropriately young girl on stage dropping F-bombs. Because they did that at the end of Comedian. At the end of the Comedian, there's a scene like that. And so, like, and the other thing that I know, and I know that logic goes out the window in this regard, but Eric, how, when he showed, there's a part where he has to show up to his daughter's recital. It's just, it's absurd. It's ridiculous and it's stupid. But he shows up at the recital. How did that choreography expect to be fitted with the song from Rent?
I don't know.
Because it's like, yeah, the choreography is the same. Okay. What?
You're right. Like, yeah, maybe that was the joke, Nick.
I don't know.
Was the joke we missed.
But I was like, wait a minute. There's no possible way that what they're doing on stage would be appropriate for the song from Rent.
Right.
And when that's going through your head, you know, instead of laughing,
yeah,
there's an issue, you know?
Yeah.
But I didn't hate it as much as you did, Eric. I did. There were a few things that did make me laugh. Jillian Bell plays like this very horny teacher who wants to you know, have sex with the students. I didn't find funny at all. I thought there were a couple of funny, like the meth stuff I thought was kind of funny. And, you know, like I said, Tracy Morgan's got a couple of laughs in it. And I'll tell you, to me, the funniest guy in the movie who cracked me up was the older African-American teacher who has just had it. He comes into the break room and just starts screaming because they're also firing people.
Right.
And the reason for Charlie Day ratting on Ice Cube is because his wife is having another baby, you know, and he needs the job and he doesn't want to get fired. So that's why he rats on Ice Cube. That's the motivation, which of course is stupid, but it is the motivation. But this guy, this older teacher who has just had it. He's got three scenes in the movie, and those three scenes were the scenes that I laughed the hardest at. Like his breakdown when he was going to steal stuff from the break room. I don't know, it cracked me up. So it's certainly not good, and I'm not recommending it. I just don't think it's as bad as you did, Eric.
Okay.
All right. So let's take a break. When we come back, we've got one more movie to talk about and then the box office. And the movie that we're going to talk about is the one with Matt Damon called The Great Wall. And we will discuss that right after we take a break on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Monday morning, so that means my dad will call in and tell a jokey time. And we will also have a Blackhawks Express. We're going to talk about great animal performances in movies and TV. And we got a list of animals that should have been nominated for Oscars, and we'll take off from there. And we're going to talk about the box office with Eric Childress. But we've got one more new movie to review for this weekend, and it's The Great Wall. We'll welcome Eric and Colin back. And by the way, gentlemen, I am taking next Monday off because of the Academy Awards, because it's just going to be, you know, I'm going to be watching it from like 4 o'clock in the afternoon till it ends at like 11. And normally I'll sleep during that period. So I'm taking the morning off. It's like a holiday for me anyway. And we could actually, we got a little time here to talk a little bit. Maybe you guys can make some predictions in the major categories.
Sure.
Yeah.
And
okay.
I also want to do a quick plug here since you guys kept name dropping 3 o'clock High. Eric and I recorded with our friend, the show, Jim Laskowski. What we've been doing every year is go backtracking 30 years and examining films that are celebrating their 30th anniversary. So we did a whole podcast about 1987.
Good year.
And on the Directors Club podcast. If you go to directorsclubpodcast.com, you can see. And we're very thorough because it's in two parts. This thing is like, I don't know, what, 4 hours podcast?
About that.
About 1987, so we cover everything in this episode.
I'm trying to remember what my number one was in 87.
I think you kept saying it was Hope and Glory.
Yeah, it was Hope and Glory. Yeah, yeah. But I know Near Dark was up there. Broadcast News, Evil Dead 2, Raising Arizona. Yeah, there were, man, that was
a
good year. It was a good year.
Yeah.
That was a good year. All right, cool. So check that out. That's our buddy Jim Laskowski, the NowPlayingNetwork.net, and you can check out the Directors Club podcast. That's pretty cool. 1987. Yeah, that's a solid year. I have to go back and look at some of the titles.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
Yeah, very, 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 very cool. Okay, so let's hear about the last big movie that we're reviewing this week. Made the most of the new releases. This weekend, and Colin, tell us about The Great Wall.
All right. Well, this is the big epic with Matt Damon that we heard about last year and is now finally coming out in theaters. And this is about one of the many legends that took place at the Great Wall. That's what the movie says at the beginning. It's a big, long prologue about the legends of all kinds that took place at the Great Wall of China. And here, Matt Damon and Pedro Pascal play a couple of mercenary warriors who get taken prisoner inside the Great Wall by an army who inhabit it. And they see that this army is under threat of giant mutant hell beasts that attack the Great Wall regularly. And eventually, their skills as warriors become useful to the army. So they help out in the fight and help with strategies and saving the day. And eventually it's discovered that the key to destroying these beasts is to kill off the mother, so that becomes the next big obstacle for them. And lest you think there's a language barrier, don't worry, Willem Dafoe is there for some reason to help translate for everybody, which is one of the many silly elements of this film. It sort of calls attention to itself, at least for me, that might turn out to be, you know, one of the more sophisticated, interesting films about this subject, considering the director is Zhang Yimou, or Yimou Zhang, is now it's being listed on IMDb. Maybe this is a good time to invert your name so that, you know, you can distinguish it from the rest of your filmography. So this is one of my, you know, always been one of my favorite international directors. You know, has got a pretty distinguished body of work.
A great body of work, Colin. He's made several great films.
Yeah, one of the most important directors to come out of China, definitely. And he's made some clunkers too, definitely. But I thought his last film, Coming Home, was kind of a comeback for him, return to form.
Yeah.
And to watch him sort of embrace the sort of standard Hollywood modern day spectacle. He's indulging all the wrong things. Really not very impressive special effects. 3D that only calls attention to the shoddy special effects. Not very interesting monsters. Action scenes that are pretty pedestrian. And a storyline that, you know, garnered some controversy last year because of this whole white savior thing that we've seen too many times in movies like Dances with Wolves and The Last Samurai and stuff like that. And we're past that. So that's kind of a tired thing as well. And though there's not much chemistry between Damon and Pascal, much less Damon and Tian Zhang, who is the semi-love interest, who is she's like the head warrior of this thing. So the whole thing just feels empty and flat and ridiculous. And coming from a director whose films are normally anything but that, it's really disheartening to watch. And so I just kind of sat there waiting for it to end. Even though it keeps moving, I mean, there's definitely the action scenes are plentiful in this film, but it's just in service to something that is beneath this director and just doesn't work.
Okay, Eric?
Yeah, I wasn't quite as disheartened with it. I think this director has been a little bit more spotty than some some people have. I'm not a particularly big fan of Hero. I liked House of Flying Daggers more. But, you know, obviously Raise the Red Lantern and some other films. You know, this guy has directed some masterful things. And this one, you know, I kind of embrace the goofiness of it a little bit more than I expected it to. And one of the reasons for that was I didn't see the movie in 3D for one. So maybe the obviousness of the fake special effects didn't bother me as much. But there are moments in the film during the action scenes that at least it seemed like he was trying something, that there were moments within the action sequences that I felt like, you know, if I was like 10 years old, I would have thought this was as cool a movie as, you know, could possibly be made. You know, this guy, you know, clearly knows how to use a visual palette. I mean, he's doing sort of the same thing he did with Hero and the defining groups and the colors and things like that. So there's always something to look at when the film isn't caked in darkness. I'm not exactly sure what accent Matt Damon is doing. I really don't know. There's not much memorable in the way of human characters. The creature design, at least, it's just basically little baby Godzilla aliens or something. And I'm fine with that. So I didn't, I just kind of more shrugged it off more than anything. And, every once in a while I go like, ooh, that's kind of cool. Like, the spinning blades within the wall and the hot air balloons and stuff like that. Just every once in a while there's an image or a moment that made me kind of sit up and like, ooh, that was kind of neat. And then I would just kind of slunk back and just kind of the same old stuff again.
Okay, we're going to break, and then I'll tell you what I thought of The Great Wall. But we'll take a break first. Eric and Colin are here. We've got you'll hear what I thought of The Great Wall, and then we're going to go through the Academy Awards are next week. They're this Sunday night, I should say. And we're going to go through some Oscar nominations and make some predictions as to who we think will win. And I'm taking that Monday morning after the Oscars off because it's a national holiday for me. So we'll do that. That's coming up as well as the box office, too. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, The Great Wall. This is a massively ridiculous movie. On so many levels, it is so ridiculous. And I just find it just so odd that it's like this. If it were like in a weird kingdom, like Middle Earth or something, I would probably had a little bit more fun. But this is an actual place. It's a real it's a real wall. It's the Great Wall of China. And there are crazy ass monsters. And I'm like, what is this? I think I would have gone along with it more if it wasn't based at the Great Wall of China and the movie's called The Great Wall.
Well, in fairness, Nick, none of us were there.
Yeah. So none of us have any proof of these crazy monsters attacking
right.
People. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a monumentally silly movie. Just like the fact that it actually in some way tries to be like historically important. It's not. It's ridiculous. It's a big monster movie. That's all it is. Now, on that level, it's kind of fun. It's ridiculous, but it's kind of fun. I thought some of the action sequences were kind of cool. And, I didn't see it in 3D either. So I don't know. The casting of Matt Damon is just wrong and weird. And Willem Dafoe is ridiculous in it. And so on that level, it is completely ridiculous. But visually, this director has an incredible eye and does some really neat stuff with the camera. And he always does. And he always has been able to do that. And I just want to say this. Tian Jing rules. She kicks ass. And I think she's the best thing in the movie. And she's been in a couple of Jackie Chan movies. And she's a badass movie. But it is just so monumentally silly. If you just leave your brain at the door, there are some scenes that are fun to watch, and it's a big creature movie, and I always have a soft spot in my heart for that kind of stuff. It's surprisingly short, it's like an hour and 40 minutes, and I thought it was going to be a lot longer than that. So it's almost an hour shorter than The Cure for Wellness. You're in, you're out, an hour and 40 minutes. You could do a lot worse. It's just an insanely ridiculous movie. So, all right, there you go. I don't know if I'm not recommending it, but it's not terrible. Okay, all right. Let's go to the Oscar nominations. Let's start with why don't we do the animated film, because this is becoming a little bit more interesting than I thought it was going to be for animated feature, because I thought for sure that Zootopia was just going to easily take it. Now the nominees are Kubo and the Two Strings, Moana, My Life as a Zucchini, The Red Turtle, and Zootopia. And I thought it was going to be a lock. I thought Zootopia for sure. But there's this, the Kubo train is running. Would you guys agree with me on that?
I do.
Yeah.
I hope you're right.
I hope so too, man.
But I've been, I've been disappointed with this before. And I'm convinced that, Academy voters pretty much ask their kids what their favorite film was of the five.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's why I still think Zootopia is still a bit of a lock on this.
Okay.
So I'm saying Zootopia is going to win.
You're going to say Zootopia?
I'm wrong. I'm hoping Kubo wins.
Well, yeah, we all love Kubo. Come on, we all love Kubo. It's the best.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
But there's also a chance, with Zootopia winning, you have that other sort of social commentary thing where that could be a big moment as well.
Right. So. Yeah. I mean, you know, Zootopia is a great movie. It is, and I enjoyed the hell out of it. It's just that Kubo and the Two Strings, I think, is just magic. I adore every frame of that movie. Eric, what do you think is going to win?
Yeah, I think it's Zootopia too.
Okay.
I mean, it's the most successful of the group. It has the message is unmistakable. You could do Moana, you could do Kubo, and you know, because they're minority characters and stuff like that. But Zootopia's got that overall art message to it, and I don't lock it in because ever since Brave won, I know you can't lock anything in this category.
Yeah.
So, but I am going with Zootopia.
Okay, I'm gonna say Kubo, and I guess I'm voting with my heart.
Yeah, so, that's okay though.
Yeah. All right, let's get into supporting actor. So supporting actor, you've got Mahershala Ali from Moonlight. You've got Jeff Bridges, Hell or High Water. Lucas Hedges, Manchester by the Sea, Dev Patel for Lion, and Michael Shannon, Chicago's own Michael Shannon, for Nocturnal Animals. Eric, who do you think?
I think it's going to be Ali.
Ali, okay.
I'm still sticking with him.
Okay. And Colin?
Yeah, definitely. I can't see it going any other way.
Yeah, I can't. I think so, too. Is there anybody? Is Lucas Hedges the dark horse here?
No, actually, Dev Patel is.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, the Weinstein train has been pushing this, and they've been getting their little boys to write stories about him. So if there's a possible upset in this category, it could be him.
Okay. All right. So supporting actress, this one is a lock. This is a complete lock, right?
Yeah.
Nobody but Viola Davis is going to take that home.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, the other nominees, Viola Davis is Fences, Naomi Harris for Moonlight, Nicole Kidman for Lion, Octavia Spencer for Hidden Figures, and Michelle Williams for Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah.
This is a lock. Viola Davis will win.
Easiest category to predict of the night.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. Okay, best actor. Casey Affleck, Manchester by the Sea, Andrew Garfield, Hacksaw Ridge, Ryan Gosling, La La Land, Viggo Mortensen for Captain Fantastic, Denzel Washington for Fences. Does the fact that Denzel won the SAG Award, does that make it a little bit closer than anybody thought?
I think it's going to be Denzel.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You think Denzel's going to win over Affleck?
I do.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, Denzel won the SAG, Casey Affleck won BAFTA, but Denzel wasn't nominated for BAFTA.
Ah.
I got a hunch that,
okay.
that they would love to give this guy 3 Oscars, and his speeches that he's been given recently have been just fantastic.
And it would be cool for both of them to win, considering that the heart and soul of Fences are those two performances.
Yeah, so. I think it's going to happen.
Okay, Colin, what do you think?
Makes a good case. I'm going to stick with Affleck on this because I think there's still a lot of Manchester by the Sea love out there. So I'm going to go with Affleck, but that's an interesting. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if Denzel won.
Okay. All right, I'm going to say Casey Affleck, too. All right. So best actress, Isabelle Huppert for Elle, Ruth Negga for Loving, Natalie Portman for Jackie, Emma Stone for La La Land, Meryl Streep for Florence Foster Jenkins. Colin, let's start with you.
Yeah, seems to be Emma Stone. I think, probably has the most momentum going here. The La La Land thing, I don't think it's sailed yet, you know, in spite of everybody's efforts to get the backlash going long before the nominations were even announced.
Yeah.
I think it's Emma Stone.
Okay. Eric?
I'm going with Emma Stone, too, and I'm also going on record that the backlash train, they can all shut the hell up.
I agree. Oh, I totally agree.
Shut the hell up hard.
Yeah.
I mean, you're boring me at this point.
It's moronic. And Emma Stone is going to win it. And I'm glad that she's going to win it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, best director. We've got Arrival with Denis Villeneuve. We've got Hacksaw Ridge with Nutcase Mel. La La Land, Damien Chazelle. Manchester by the Sea, Kenneth Lonergan. And Moonlight, Barry Jenkins. Eric, what do you think?
I think it's going to be Damien Chazelle. Mm-hmm. I've stuck with that since for a while now, and I'm not jumping off.
Okay. And Colin?
Yeah, I think so too. I think Lonergan gets the, you know, might have another award coming to him in the night. You know, Barry Jenkins is, I think, still a little too new to the scene, for the Academy's liking. So I think, Chazelle.
Okay. Real quick with the screenplays. Original screenplay, Hell or High Water, La La Land, The Lobster, Manchester by the Sea, 20th Century Women. Manchester by the Sea, you guys?
I think so.
Colin?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What's the, is La La Land the dark horse here?
I would think so. Some sort of massive sweep that would be included in it. But I think this will be the Manchester win.
Okay. Adapted screenplay, Arrival, Fences, Hidden Figures, Lion, Moonlight. This is an interesting one. Colin, what do you think?
I'm gonna guess Moonlight on this one.
Okay.
Yeah, Arrival won the Writers Guild tonight. The reason it won the adapted is because Moonlight was in the original category.
Oh.
So Moonlight won original, Arrival won adapted,
right.
But Moonlight is now against it and adapted, Moonlight's going to win.
Yeah, Moonlight will probably take that one for sure. So, all right, well, those are the major categories. Now, Best Picture, Arrival, Fences, Hacksaw Ridge, Hell or High Water, Hidden Figures, La La Land, Lion, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. We all kind of know what's going to happen here, don't we?
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be La La Land.
I hope so.
Yeah. So La La Land. Colin, you agree?
Yeah. I don't want to say it's a lock because after last year's big surprise, you know.
Hey, I called Spotlight, man.
I know you did.
I called it.
Yeah, I know, but it's still a surprise. You may have called it, but it's still a surprise.
Right.
And so these things get harder and harder to predict. And it seems to be like, the dark horse here is Moonlight, right?
Eric? I would say so, yeah.
Yeah. The people have been trying to play the Hidden Figures thing for a while now because it's the
right.
box office and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And I don't see that in the slightest. I'd hope that doesn't happen, but
yeah. All right.
La La Land is going to win.
Yeah, we're going to go with La La Land. All right, guys, have fun. And I know we'll all be watching it at the same time. And,
yep.
And by the way, since we're not on next week, we have to talk about Get Out the following week.
I'm sure we will.
Oh, my God, I can't wait. Colin, thanks, man.
All righty.
And I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good.
Okay, there you go. There's Colin and there's Eric. We're going to take a break. We'll come back with Eric and the box office right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. It's Monday morning. That means Monday morning movie reviews. We talk about the box office. We also threw out our major category Oscar predictions because the Academy Awards are Sunday night. And we're not going to be on next Monday morning taking the Oscar night off. We're going to talk box office right now. Eric Childress joins us. And let's get Eric back in here. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
All right. You know, we were talking in the last segment about, you know, next week is Get Out.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to that. The next 3 weeks are movies that I am unbelievably excited about.
Get Out,
Logan, Kong.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Yeah. I think you're going to be very happy. But I will say this right now. You're going to be very happy over the next 2 weeks.
Okay. Yeah,
the embargo is up for Logan, and I don't care who knows it. It's great.
Yeah, everybody. I've not heard one negative thing about Logan. And I'm really, really excited about it. And the fact that it's kind of taken a different tone, and in style and everything, and that it's rated R.
Yeah.
And the kid looks great. Is the kid great?
Yeah, kid's very good.
Oh, man.
Kid's very good. It's the best of the X-Men movies.
Oh, man.
Period.
I'm looking at Dan's face right now, Eric.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have a spotty, really. I mean, I think I like about half the X-Men movies.
Yeah.
There's no contest.
Mine is still First Class.
I like Days of Future Past.
I like that one, too.
That was my favorite up until this point. This one kills it.
Oh, man. I can't wait.
Yeah.
Dan, excited, are you?
Very much so now, yeah.
And let me tell you something. I said this earlier online. The trailer that they have for Logan with the Johnny Cash Hurt cover
Yeah.
is one of the best trailers I've ever seen.
Yeah.
given, especially after seeing the movie now, that they do such a fantastic job not really spoiling anything. It is a near perfect trailer.
Yeah, it's a great trailer. The first time I saw it, I was floored by it. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
All right, very excited. That's in a couple of weeks. All right, let's talk about the movies over the weekend. The Lego Batman movie, $34.2 million. 2 weeks, it's up to almost $99 million.
Yeah, behind the pace of the original, but that's, you know, since last week. So, I mean, that was a decent hold this week. It'll do well tomorrow on the holiday.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's still looking like it, $200 million could very well happen for it.
That's
so
cool.
They'll be very happy with that.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Number two, 50 Shades Darker, $20.9 million. And you actually thought that my main man John Wick was going to sneak in there.
I actually did. I mean, 50 Shades Darker has held up a bit better than I thought it was going to. Not that John Wick didn't hold up very well. It actually did hold up quite well.
Mm-hmm.
But 50 Shades Darker had they released this very kind of ingeniously, because last year they released it on President's Day weekend that also happened to have Valentine's Day on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
So that led to, you know, obviously a huge blow up and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Here they released it the week before. Okay, before President's Day weekend. So you not only get the holiday in its second weekend, but Valentine's Day was on Tuesday this past week.
Right.
And it did so well on Valentine's Day that at that point it actually surpassed the Lego Batman's gross.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was ahead midweek, and then Lego Batman overtook it again this weekend.
Right.
So women obviously aren't tired of this crap.
Yep. number three, The Great Wall. $18 million, is that considered good? I mean, I know it's doing well overseas.
It did better than people thought it was going to do. Not much better, but it did better in the U.S. than people thought it was going to. I didn't think it was going to do that particularly this well. I thought it was going to do more in like 14, 15.
Yeah.
But the thing is, this is a $150 million production.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, this movie isn't going to see a dime in the black until it reaches about $520 million.
Man.
Okay, and the thing is that it's doing monster business overseas. I mean, up until this weekend, it had done over $170 million in China alone.
Right.
You know, because of the historical accuracies and stuff.
Right.
So this movie's doing fantastic business over there. But is it going to do enough to get this thing out? Because in the U.S., this thing's not going to reach $60
million. Right.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, that's tough.
We'll have to watch that going forward.
Number four, John Wick Chapter 2, $16.5 million, up to $58.6 million for 2 weeks. That's pretty solid.
Yeah, your boy is nothing to be ashamed of
here.
It's right now on pace to like just do about $102, $103 million.
Oh, that's all right. That's cool.
Yeah, so that's absolutely a win for this series. So
right.
Chapter 3 will be on the way.
Let's
soon.
Do it, Len. Now, I want it now. number 5, Fist Fight, $12.9 million. That's about what you would think, right?
Yeah. I thought that there was a possible, if this movie was better, it probably would have done better. But the reviews are pretty brutal on
it.
So I think
yeah.
that kind of killed it a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, not. I mean, I think the budget's only like $20, $25 million for this. But
Dean Richards was particularly brutal.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I gave it a big fat F on his.
I'm kind of in agreement. Almost in agreement with
that. There were parts of it that I laughed at. I got to tell you. And I will say this: if it were not Charlie Day and somebody else who is a bigger draw, I think it would have made more money.
Possibly.
Seriously, Central Intelligence, you've got The Rock. I mean, that, you know, that's it. You put the Rock in this movie and it would have made $30 million. Easy.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And I still love Charlie Day. He rules. Number six, Hidden Figures, still doing tremendous business.
Crazy money for that movie.
Yeah, man, oh, man. And it is the crowd pleaser of the season.
Yeah.
Number seven, Split, $7 million. Man, oh, man, what a big hit this thing is still.
Let me tell you how big a hit this thing is for Universal, because this movie only cost $9 million.
Oh my god.
Okay, so this is the biggest hit for Universal, the biggest non-Illumination hit you're seeing Secret Life of Pets since Jurassic World.
Wow.
Yeah, technically, I mean, in the profit estimate, this is the biggest profit margin, non-cartoon profit margin for Universal since Jurassic World.
Man, oh man.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, M. Night looked like his career was going nowhere.
Yep.
For a while, and then boom,
Yep, and then Nick DiGiulio liked an M. Night Shyamalan movie, and look what happened.
That's right.
Yes, he upset the time-space continuum, the vortex.
Sorry about that.
The plane has been opened.
Sorry about that, Doc Brown. I apologize. A Dog's Purpose, 5.5 million, bringing its total up to 50. It's 0.6.
Yeah, it's held on pretty well. Looked like, you know, you get a few more million in there. This is going to be a small little hit for Universal.
Okay, and then, of course, La La Land coming in at 9th.
Yeah,
4.5 million. It's made a ton of money. I got to say this, Eric, a couple of times I went to the movies this week.
Yeah.
On Saturday when we went, there were a ton of people at the Village Crossroads with their day one passes around their neck. To catch up on the movies.
People are still, Hidden Figures and La La Land, obviously, and Lion even is not in the top 10, but, you know, these are the three movies that people are really catching up on.
Yeah. Because they've got AMC is offering to show all the movies in 3 days.
Yeah.
Three separate days. I think it's three movies a day.
Yeah.
And they were I saw a lot of people walking around the Village Crossing with the Oscar things around their neck.
Yeah, and so, the one thing that this movie has going for it that Hidden Figures doesn't is it's made like over $200 million worldwide,
right,
as well.
Right.
So this is just a massive global hit.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm happy about it. And then number 10, man.
Oof.
Cure for Wellness, $4.2 million, and it's a pretty terrible movie. But how much did it cost?
$40 million is the budget.
$40 million,
and probably cost about another $30-40 million for prints and advertising and stuff.
Man,
so yeah, I mean, it's just like it's you know, you're coming off the Lone Ranger, which is one of the biggest bombs in modern history.
Yeah.
I mean, I know $40 million isn't a lot of money these days to spend on the money, but, you know, he might have been better served doing like a Blumhouse film.
Yeah.
Because this is like going to be like two major losses in a row for Gore.
Yeah.
And he's going to need to find a hit soon.
Yeah. What do we know about the guys who directed? Because I'm seeing the trailers now all over the place for the new Pirates movie.
Yeah.
Do we know who the directors are?
Directed some. I don't know if it was a foreign film recently. I just read about this too, and I'm blanking on it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But yeah, they had directed something that was acclaimed.
Okay.
Then I can't remember what it is.
It's crazy. I've seen two trailers now for Dead Men Don't Speak or whatever the hell it's called. Johnny Depp is barely in. He's not in the first trailer.
No, he's not.
And in the second trailer, he's in it for 2 seconds, and he's completely covered in mud.
Right.
I'm like, what? I mean, don't you want to put the star in the trailer, don't you think?
Right. Yeah, no, I think that would probably be a good marketing strategy. Okay, that's what they directed. I just looked it up. That movie Kon-Tiki.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which I wasn't. Oh, and Max Manus, Man of War. I saw those. I'm not a fan of either of those movies,
okay,
actually. So maybe I spoke too soon.
Yeah.
They have an eye, though. So maybe it'll be like Gore's movie, it'd be visually interesting, but not much else.
Well, the trailer, you know, like the Javier Bardem stuff is really pretty cool. Like the effects and stuff like that. That's pretty cool. Kind of.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, it's got to be an upgrade from Rob Marshall.
Yeah, no question about it. No question about it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, what are we predicting next week? How do you think Get Out is going to do?
I'm really curious to see how it's going to do. I'm thinking teens. I'm not thinking some sort of big, you know, splash or whatnot.
Right.
It's a movie that has no stars. I mean, it's got, you know, Bradley Redford, Catherine Keener, people who watch Girls know Allison Williams.
Sure.
But not many people obviously know the lead actor.
Right.
Or Keith Stansfield, unless they're big Atlanta fans.
Right. Well, that's
so,
me.
I mean, they're selling on Jordan Peele, but he's not in the movie.
Right.
And not like he's a biggest draw anyway. Keanu, you know, didn't exactly do great.
No.
So I think that the trailers will intrigue enough people to maybe do like sort of like a 15, 16 million kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I think Lego is still going to win next week.
Yeah, Lego Batman will still be number one. And I mean, the only big release is Get Out next week. So it we should have a similar list, right?
I think so. Yeah, I think you might see 50 Shades Darker, I'm hoping at least, drop a little bit further. I think John Wick will still have a pretty good thing, and then March will start to get crazy with Logan and Kong and then Beauty and the Beast, which
right.
is going to be phenomenal.
Those are going to be huge. And and also, obviously, you know, after the Academy Awards, like, you know, people will go see La La Land again, or if they haven't seen it, they certainly will. So next week, like a week from today, people will start going out to see La La Land after it inevitably wins Best Picture.
Yeah, La La Land, I believe you'll see that stick in the top 10 next week. Hidden Figures, that might drop off a little bit more, but yeah. And
okay.
Care for Wellness will be nowhere to be found.
Almost was nowhere to be found this week.
Right.
All right. All right, Eric, always a pleasure. Enjoy the Oscars. I know that we'll probably be texting one another during the ceremony, and we'll talk in a couple of weeks when we get to review Logan.
That sounds good.
Very exciting. All right, Eric, thanks, man.
You got it.
All right, Eric Childress, Colin Suter, they join me every week for the Monday morning movie reviews. And again, I will be off next week. I'm taking the national holiday of the Academy Awards morning after off. So there you go. All right, we got to take a break here. We got weather, we got traffic, and then we're going to talk about the best animal performances in TV. Who are your favorite animal performances in TV and movies and all that cool stuff? 312-981-7200. All right, let's take a break. Good morning. Hi. What the hell? It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio till 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We'll have a Blackhawks Express recapping yesterday's fun game. That's coming up. We're also going to talk about best animal performances in movies and TV and your favorite animals and and all that cool stuff. I just wanted to mention, I told Dan this off the air. I was tooling around on IMDb as I'm wont to do during our movie segment. You know, when we're reviewing movies, I go to the page of the movie that we're reviewing on IMDb, and I was just looking at the coming soon pages, and one of them, of course, is the new Fast and Furious movie, which is called The Fate of the Furious. It is the 8th Fast and Furious movie. Now, regular listeners to this program know that I have an absolute love for these movies, that they're insanely ridiculous, and I love them. So I was looking at the page. Now, here's the deal, though. Now, I don't even know what to say about this. I swear, I don't even know what to say. Jim, do you like these movies?
I think the only one I've seen, in all honesty, is the first one.
Oh, okay. Well, there's only 7 more that you have to catch up on.
Yeah, I got some work to do.
I think they're great. I love them. It's just completely absurd and completely ridiculous, and they get crazier they do crazier stuff and stunts and chase scenes. They just get crazier and more ridiculous as the movies go. And in the trailer for this one, there's a submarine. There's a giant submarine chasing them on ice. I don't even know where to begin here. So anyway, I love these movies, and the new one comes out in April, and I was just looking at the IMDb page. Are you ready for the running time? Here's the running time. The running time of The Fate and the Furious, the 8th Fast and Furious movie, is 2 hours and 40 minutes. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes long.
And there's a submarine involved somehow?
There's a submarine chasing cars.
I could probably do this.
I just get 2 hours and 40 minutes. I don't even know what to say.
You know, do I need to see the other 7
no,
before I have a first
No,
before I see
it's
this
just
one?
Loud, okay. Shiny things crashing. That's all it is. They're fun, though. They're really fun movies, but my God, 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Seems like it could be overkill, but...
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's insane. I thought the last one was long. I think the last one was like 2 hours and 15 minutes or something. So 2 hours and 40 minutes long. Oh, my God. And I can't wait to see it. I can't wait to see it. It's so ridiculous. Anyway, I was looking back because, you know, in the movie segment... Colin and Eric were talking about how they recorded a podcast with our friend Jim Leskowski, the Directors Club podcast, where they went back to 1987 and looked at the year of 1987, where obviously the movies that came out in 1987 turned 30 this year. So I reached back and I grabbed my list of the best movies of 1987 because I got curious. So this was my top 10 from 1987, which was my second year as a film critic on this radio station. '85 was my first year reviewing movies here. And so that's where I've got my best of lists that go all the way back to 1985 when I first sort of became a pro, professional. So here are the top 10 in 1987 that I have. Number 10 was Street Smart. It's a really terrific movie with Christopher Reeve and a breakout role for Morgan Freeman. That was the movie that really broke Morgan Freeman. He got nominated for an Academy Award for it, too, for supporting actor. He played a pimp. And Christopher Reeve plays a reporter. And it's a really terrific movie. Number 9, Broadcast News, which I would put higher now. That's a movie that I think is aged. That's a tremendous movie. Number 8, House of Games, the David Mamet film. Number 7, The Stepfather, one of the scariest movies ever. The original, not the stupid remake. Number 6, Full Metal Jacket, came out that year. What an incredible year, 1987. Number 5, The Last Emperor, which ended up winning Best Picture. Number 4 is Barfly with Mickey Rourke. Number 3, Near Dark. Number 2, Evil Dead 2. And number 1, Hope and Glory. So those were my top 10 in 1987, which was a very, very good year, as Sinatra says. So there you go. Hey, listen, come on out to my film club screening on Tuesday, March 7th, celebrating the 25th anniversary. Again, you want to feel old. The 25th anniversary of Reservoir Dogs on the big screen. The big breakout movie for Quentin Tarantino, a tremendous movie. It's going to be so much fun to see on the big screen. It's the 25th anniversary screening. It's digitally remastered, and it's going to be a blast. And it's only $10 to get in. Parking is free. And you can get there about 7 o'clock. Go to Bogart's on the second floor of the Movie Co. Theater in Rosemont. Have some dinner, and the movie starts at 8. You can have cocktails during the movie if you so desire. And it's just going to be a blast. It's $10. Parking is free. You can go to Fandango.com and reserve your seats right now. Fandango.com. And we'll see you on Tuesday, March 7th for Reservoir Dogs on the big screen. And reserve your seats now, because I think this one's going to be I think tickets are going to be flying for this thing. So reserve your seats now at Fandango.com. And we'll see you on Tuesday, March 7th, Reservoir Dogs on the big screen.